This is Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
Stanford 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
This is
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture on the air and online.
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Bienvenidos.
Atenea Americana.
Welcome. Bienvenidos.
From Stanford to the world. Knowledge of scientific achievement and space exploration move forward, we still have a lot to learn. Our planet is changing in a pace that we cannot control, and our life will be affected in ways that we cannot fully understand yet. As we study Earth and other planets, we come closer to feel all these holes. Understanding the fragility of life and its origins may give us a clue on how to preserve it and how to change to survive under other environments. Understanding change in the universe and other planets help us preserve and understand ours. Today, we have a planetary scientist from NASA and SETI Institute, who specializes in a new field. He is an astrobiologist who is trying to understand life in all its forms, the creation and the evolution of it in Earth and even all around the universe throughout research and observation.
Through looking at other planets, we can understand better what's happening in our own planet, and we can understand that it doesn't take much for things to change in the wrong direction. We know that Mars 3 billion years ago was a planet probably very similar to the Earth, with water on the surface, maybe even oceans, and now is a completely dry and frozen desert. Our own planet still has lots of mysteries, and by no means space exploration obviates the necessity of studying the Earth. The Earth is another planet.
Dr. Alfonso Dávila will be talking to us about this interesting field and its latest discoveries and the future of space exploration. So, Alfonso, thank you for being with us again. He is a research scientist at SETI and at NASA. He's an astrobiologist, and he studies, of course, as the word say, the possibility of life outside our planet. He is very savvy in planetary science and ecology, and he's here to talk a little bit to us about what he's doing, what the research is about, and, of course, about life in other planets. Thank you for coming.
Yep, thank you for having me.
So, you're originally from Spain.
I'm from Spain, yeah. I was born and I grew up in Spain. And then a few years after college, I moved to Germany to continue studying. Mm-hmm. And about 8 years ago, I came to California to continue my research. And I decided to stay here. Mm-hmm. Not a bad place to stay.
Great, yeah. We love it.
I love it too.
Astrobiology is something that there is some building in a faculty somewhere that you study that and you put it in the curriculum and people come and study, or is like a path that you found yourself studying different science and putting them together?
Right now, it's a choice that students can make to study mm-hmm. astrobiology. When I came into astrobiology, I didn't come into astrobiology. I almost stumbled into it. It wasn't planned. I never heard about astrobiology until I came to California. That was my personal experience. But now astrobiology has gained credentials and reputation, so to speak, mostly due to all the missions that have been going on Mars and other planets and moons in the past 10, 15 years. The amount of knowledge and data we have about planets and moons is now so large that it makes sense to have a scientific field like astrobiology mm-hmm. that focuses on understanding all that data, all that information, and to try to put it in the context of life. What does it mean? What we learn about Mars, what we learn about Jupiter and Europa and the moons of Jupiter, what does it mean about life? Mm-hmm. That's what astrobiology is trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And then there is some understanding of this related with the origin of life, so we can understand how life came to be and what it has to do with asteroids and other planets.
That's correct. Astrobiology is a coin with two sides. One side is the search for extraterrestrial life. The other side is understanding the origin of life. Mm-hmm. And both are actually very related questions. Understanding the origin of life is probably one of the most difficult scientific questions we can ask ourselves. Mm-hmm. And people have been wondering, how did life originate on our planet for many, many years? And actually, in the 1950s and thereabouts, people who were actually looking at the problem, trying to understand the origin of life, came to a conclusion that very likely we will never know how life originated on Earth until we find another example of life somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Just because we don't have the tools necessary to understand the origin of life. It's something that happened a long time ago. There is no record of what happened, and it's very hard to reproduce it in the lab, the chemistry. Mm. But if we go to another planet, like Mars, for example, and we find evidence of life on Mars, and it's made out of a different type of chemistry, maybe similar chemistry but fundamentally different than us, in other words, if there is life on Mars that is not related to us, we call that a second genesis, then no longer we have only one data point to understand life, which is what we have now, life on Earth. Mm-hmm. If there is life on Mars, then we have two data points. And between two points, you can draw a line. And one line tells you something already. Wow. If then we find life somewhere else, not on Mars, but maybe on Europa, then we have three data points. And all of a sudden, our understanding of life multiplies orders of magnitude to the point that maybe then we understand what's required and what's necessary for life to originate on a planet, like on Earth, for example. So these are two questions that are very, very much related.
It is so important to understand the universe, to understand life on Earth. For example,
like they say
that a big collision of planets gave the inclination that today give us the fourth season, which is basic for life. This collision gave us the moon, which bring the tides, which is also basic for life. And another big collision changed the environment that stopped the era of dinosaurs and opened the era of mammals and, of course, us. The understanding of planets, stars, and space can bring us a little bit closer to know how life on Earth and then how to preserve it as we know it is part of our survival. Another of the theories we talked before is the one that life on Earth actually came from an asteroid that had them frozen. And we may even share these basic proteins, which made cells later on, with other life forms outside Earth.
We understand Earth now in a way that we never understood Earth, thanks to what we know about other places. We can now understand the importance of things like, as you say, the moon, the oceans, the plate tectonics, the movement of the continents, the composition of the atmosphere. We understand what happens to a planet when the atmospheric composition changes. That's very relevant. We can talk about it later about climate change and CO2. Mm. We understand that life depends on a specific, at least life as we know it, depends on a very specific number of circumstances. It's a fragile thing. It needs to be protected. We understand how these different factors play on Earth, how the atmosphere and the oceans communicate, how the continents move through time and how this affects life and how life affects these things, we certainly are capable of changing the composition of the atmosphere. It's happening now, it's happened before, and this impacts the way life evolves on the planet. Through looking at other planets, we can understand better what's happening in our own planet. And we can understand that it doesn't take much for things to change in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
We have the example on Venus, a planet that we think it was very similar to the Earth a long, long time ago. And now it's 500 degrees centigrade on the surface. Mm-hmm. It's hell. It's a hellish planet. It happened on Mars. We know that Mars 3 billion years ago was a planet probably very similar to the Earth with water on the surface, maybe even oceans, and now is a completely dry and frozen desert. So if it happened there, it could happen here if we're not careful. It's going to happen. Eventually it's going to happen. It's the nature of things. But it can happen soon if we're not careful, or it can happen a long time into the future if we're careful about what we do with our planet.
The B612 Foundation is a non-profit organization that aims to build, launch, and operate the first privately funded deep space mission, a space telescope to be placed in orbit around the Sun. The telescope will be used to map our inner solar system to better track the trajectories of Earth-crossing asteroids. The goal is to reduce the risk of a catastrophic collision. If you'd like to learn more or contribute to this effort, visit them at b612foundation.org. What about these theories of terraforma from other planets? Well, maybe they are more like conceptual things than reality, but are they also thought in a way to remake Earth or restore what is happening on Earth right now?
Terraforming is an issue that it's caught people's attentions for a while, for a long time. People still think about it, not that many, but it's something that is beyond science fiction. Maybe 40 years ago, people thought about it as science fiction. But again, because we have so much data and knowledge about other planets, we can now better estimate or better guess what it would take to turn a planet like Mars into a planet more similar like the Earth, for example. That's what terraformation is, another planet into something like the Earth. Now, there is a number of very interesting issues related to terraformation. One of them is whether it's possible to do it. And technologically, there are things that we could do to change Mars, to make it a bit more like the Earth. I mean, as we just said, we're actually good at changing a planet. We're changing our planet constantly. Oh, yeah. We're changing the composition of the oceans. We change the landscape. We change the atmosphere. We have proven that we can change a planet as human beings. We could do that on Mars. And there wouldn't be any groups there probably complaining about it. Probably there would be. And probably they would have a reason, because that takes me to the next point. So one question is whether it's possible to do it. The other question, maybe more important, is should we do it? Should humans go to another planet and change it? And that's a fascinating question, that people have been asking that question. People at NASA Ames, Chris McKay, for example, who's been my mentor and we work closely every day, he's thought long and deep about the ethical issues related to terraformation and exploration. And there are certainly ethical issues. Why you should do it, how you should do it, when should you do it. And so that's a fascinating, terraformation is a fascinating issue that goes beyond science into morality and ethics.
One of our worst nightmares on Earth, like thinking that other alien form is going to come and do that to us.
Well, yeah, exactly. And don't do unto others what you don't want them to doing to you.
Yeah.
So I guess we should be applying that to ourselves. But there are caveats. There are circumstances where, for example, it would make sense to go to a planet and change it. There are circumstances where it wouldn't make sense and we shouldn't do it. As individuals, we might decide when it makes sense or not. Some people will argue, for example, that if we go to Mars and it turns out that we find microbes on Mars, even if just a handful of them, we shouldn't definitely do anything to harm them. They've been there for a long time. We should do everything possible so that they're not affected by us. We could actually consider changing Mars so that it improves their lives. We go to Mars and we're coming to help. Mm-hmm. We're not changing Mars into something that is good for us. We're changing Mars into something that is good for Martians. Mm-hmm. Of course, that would require a degree of knowledge that we don't have about what it takes to make a planet better for their inhabitants.
Yeah.
But it's a question that it's valid. It's a valid question. So we should be asking that. Now, if we go to Mars and it turns out we don't find any life, then why shouldn't we change it? Some people think we should, especially if it's good for us. Some people think that there is planet, even if it's a dead planet, it still has intrinsic value and we shouldn't touch it. That's what makes the question complicated and at the same time fascinating.
This is Atenea Americana, and I am your host, Isabel Jubes. You may find this and all my shows at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. This is a bilingual cultural show, bringing you a window to the Latin and Hispanic universe. Every week, for 2 hours, one in English and one in Spanish, from Stanford to the world. You can also be part of this, leaving me your comments, sharing your thoughts, and even more at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. I invite you to be part of this. And today, we're talking with Dr. Alfonso Dávila about research, about space, about Earth, and astrobiology.
There are places on Earth where we practice and we humans see or imagine how it will be living in other planets. Can you talk a little bit about the research that you guys do and where do you do it?
Yeah, there is an aspect of astrobiology which is more human exploration, which combines science and human exploration, combines human activities. And I've been involved in some projects, but it's not my area of expertise, but there is people at NASA Ames who are doing really interesting work in that respect. And so there are certain places on Earth where we have established some kind of base, a place where we can go and do science. And since these are places that are very remote, and in some ways they seem like another planet, the middle of one desert or in Antarctica, or even underwater, it's like it's not our usual environment. Mm-hmm. To us humans, can look as alien, as a different planet. It's an excellent opportunity to also see how humans could operate on another planet, and mm-hmm. they could do things like science on another planet. So people go there, they do their science, but they do their science, for example, wearing astronaut suits, to see how difficult or how easy it is to do science mm-hmm. wearing a big, heavy astronaut suit. Or they use vehicles that we want to use on other planets, rovers, mm-hmm. or we just simulate what it takes to coordinate people. Mm-hmm. When you're, for example, doing a science investigation in a remote place up in the Arctic, you can have people here in California communicating with you and telling you to do things, which is something that probably we will do when we're on Mars. Mm-hmm. Astronauts on Mars will make their own decisions, but they also obey orders from people on Earth, and they will tell them, go and look at that rock, or go and look at that mountain. Yeah. And so we can see how the best communicate these ideas and best follow this strategy, we can use places on Earth to test.
Yeah, and probably there will be also maybe 10 people on Mars, and then you have 2,000 people in a lab over here that will
exactly.
give better information. To
a lot of the brain power is going to stay on Earth, and it's going to be used to guide and help these astronauts to do their operations, which is something that already happened during the Apollo missions. It's nothing new. But what's new now is that we know how to do that in these places, and we can improve the technology to do it by going to these places.
Last year, this lady from MIT, she made like this very small and light, I think she called it biosuit, that she say will be ideal to take to places like Mars, because there is also the difference between each suit is different if it's for the moon or for a different gravity or for a space or for the ISS.
That's right. There's a number of groups looking at the issue of how to dress an astronaut. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the same way we dress differently for different occasions, mm-hmm. astronauts will dress differently in different planets. Mars has some requirements. It's cold, it's dry, there is radiation. They require oxygen and water and whatnot. The moon was different. In terms of mobility, there are different requirements. Astronauts will need to move on Mars in different ways than they move on the moon. Gravity is different. Mm-hmm. So there is active research, different groups working in the U.S. and in other countries trying to improve the way astronauts go about. And not only improve their way, but also improve their safety. Falling down on Mars can have very important consequences. It's not the same as falling down on Earth. And so making sure that when you fall down, because we will fall down, that nothing happens, it's very important. So safety is number one in the development of those technologies as well.
So when you go to Chile, you wear the suits and you try them?
We haven't done that in Chile yet, although they've been within Chile, there've been people trying to come up with this type of simulations, which are not only interesting for the reasons we've discussed, but they're also very interesting for the public. People like to go to a place near their house and see astronauts looking like they're on another planet. Kids love these type of experiences because it allows them to see things that you normally don't see. People dressed in weird suits and moving awkwardly and doing weird things. So it's a great public outreach tool. Mm-hmm. And so countries recognize that, and more countries are trying to establish this kind of basis. I haven't done that in Chile, but there is one here in Utah, the Mars Desert Research Station, MDRS, which I think it's coordinated by the Mars Society. And every year there is groups of astronauts, which are composed of students and researchers. And they go to the MDRS, spend 2 weeks. They different crews go at different times, and they do their science and they simulate their human exploration. There is another one that it's been going on for a number of years now in the Arctic. It's also led by a SETI Institute researcher, Pascal Lee.
Friend of the show.
Of the show. Then probably the fans of the show know the story, so I won't go into the details. But that's a very interesting project up in the Arctic, which has the added interest of being remote, cold, extreme. There is another person at Ames, Darlene Lim, a friend of mine. She's doing human and science exploration underwater. So in their case, they're studying a lake in Canada, and the lake has very interesting scientific aspects, some very interesting microorganisms growing, living in the water. Mm-hmm. But in order to study those microorganisms, they use divers, and they also use submarines. So what they thought is a diver is a great example of an astronaut. Mm-hmm. Is a human being with a suit living in a deadly environment. Mm-hmm. If the suit fails, the diver is in trouble, just like an astronaut in space. And the submarines are excellent analogs to ATVs or vehicles that astronauts use to move around, rovers. Or, again, it's a vehicle that protects you, but if there is an issue in underwater, you're in trouble. So they recognize the value of looking at the operations with divers and submarines, thinking of it as if it was a space activity. And so they've been improving and perfecting and optimizing protocols, communications, checks, tests, and how to do science in those conditions.
Free Speech TV is an independent, publicly supported nonprofit TV platform that reaches 35 million households in the U.S. Using both television and the internet, Free Speech TV inspires viewers to become civically engaged in building a more just, equitable, and sustainable society. You can get involved by joining an online community, subscribing to the e-guide or RSS feed, sharing videos, of course, making a donation. For more information, visit freespeech.org.
And today, we're talking with Dr. Alfonso Dávila about research, about space, about Earth, and astrobiology.
And in a way, deep sea, what is happening very deep in the ocean is as alien to us as whatever is happening outside.
Or more. I mean, the fact is there's been more humans have gone to the moon than to the deepest reaches of the ocean on Earth.
And now we know that it's bigger than we knew a few months ago that it was.
So definitely our own planet still has lots of mysteries. And by no means space exploration obviates the necessity of studying the Earth. The Earth is another planet. I always tell that to students. Astrobiology is not just about other planets. Astrobiology is about every planet, including the Earth. We also have to look within, not just outside.
Yeah, and it is interesting that even in the Tech Museum for the kids, the exhibition for the space exploration is in the same area where deep water exploration.
That makes sense.
One beside the other.
Yeah.
And they put the same kind of suits and they can taste the same kind of rubbers. And
it's a similar problem. Lots of the complications of going to space apply to going underwater.
Mm-hmm. And have you also been researching in Spain, in the Rio Tinto area?
I've done some work in Rio Tinto. I haven't been there in a number of years, which is too bad because it's a place that I really like to go. I have friends who work there, and the place is a fantastic place. Not just scientifically, the food is really good. But it's a place that I've enjoyed working in the past. Rio Tinto is a very interesting place because it's like an open window to Mars in the past. When we are in Rio Tinto, we're kind of looking at Mars 3 billion years ago. Mm-hmm. And we look at things that could have been happening on the surface of Mars in terms of living organisms, running water, the chemistry that happened there. So through studying Rio Tinto, we can understand better things about Mars. And that's a great opportunity. And it's close to home, so it's perfect
for me. It's always good. But and then when you go to Chile, then you have the opportunity to see these new microorganisms that nobody knew that they exist. They actually thought that there were patches in Chile that were lifeless.
That's right. Chile symbolizes in a way what's happened in terms of in the larger scale in biology in the past 40 or 50 years. I'll give you an example, and then we'll go back to Chile. In 1975, there was the first mission to search for life on another planet. The first and so far the only one. That was the Viking mission. They went to Mars, two landers, searching for life. Actually looking, conducting experiments to prove that or disprove that there is life on Mars. Back then, our understanding of life was not as complete as it is now. It's not complete by far, but back then was a lot less complete. And one of the things we didn't really understand were the extremes of life. Mm-hmm. How extreme an environment needs to be so that life cannot exist anymore. Mm-hmm. That's what we call now extremophiles and extreme environments. Now we understand that there is places on Earth that we call extreme environments. They're extreme because conditions that are not what we're used to as humans. Because it's very salty or it's very cold or it's very warm. It's outside of what we as humans are comfortable with. We call them extremes. Mm-hmm. Just because we like to call things with respect to ourselves. We're still the center of the universe in many aspects. But we've learned that in these extreme environments, there's still life. And in some cases, the organisms living in extreme environments are doing very well. In fact, they're doing as well as we do in our normal environment. They're doing so well that in some cases, you take those organisms out of their extreme environments and you put them in a, quote, normal environment, and they die.
Yeah.
So extreme is a very relative term. But the point of the matter is that since the Viking missions, we've learned that there is extreme environments on Earth where life still thrives, can survive, and can grow. And that's been important for planetary sciences because Mars is a very extreme environment. Mm-hmm. It's the mother of all the extreme environments, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so by studying life in extreme environments, we understand the limits of life, and that allows us to understand better the habitability of other planets like Mars, whether it's possible for life to exist there or not.
Thank you for listening to Atenea Americana, your house of culture in the radio and online. In this bilingual show, I bring you every week 1 hour in English and 1 hour in Spanish, opening a window to the cultural Hispanic world. You can hear in the intro and at the final of the show, as well as right now, music from the legend of Latin jazz, Oscar Hernandez. This and all my shows are in StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org, where I wait for your comments. I invite you to be part of this.
And today we're talking with Dr. Alfonso Dávila about research, about space, about Earth, and astrobiology.
So the Atacama symbolizes in a way this the same revolution. The Atacama was considered not only extreme, but it was considered lifeless, non-habitable, only 10, 15 years ago. Because experiments done in the Atacama, they always came negative. Experiments to search for life, they always came negative. We can't find life. There are no microbes. We can't even extract DNA from soils, which is something that you can extract from a table. It's very easy to extract DNA everywhere, not in the Atacama. And just a few years ago, around 2005, a researcher from Spain, Jacek Vierzkos, he made a discovery. He realized that in some of the driest parts of the Atacama, where we thought that life was not possible, it was so extreme that life was not possible, he discovered that the inside of rocks made of salt actually contained living organisms. Not the soils, not other rocks, but inside the salt. And only inside the salt he could find those organisms. And the reason is because the salt was providing that which is missing in the Atacama, which is important for life, which is liquid water. The Atacama is dry, which means it never rains. In fact, it rains every now and then, but it's like every 10 years or so, there is a small rainfall that lasts a few minutes. That's not enough to sustain life, plants, animals, or even bacteria, microorganisms living in the soil. But the salt, what it does is it has the capacity to get water vapor from the atmosphere. The microbes living in the salt, they don't need to wait for the rain to fall. The salt gets the water for them straight from the atmosphere and condenses it into liquid, and then the microbes can use that liquid water for their own activities.
And what happens when you open the rock? Does it die?
Most likely. I mean, I'm going to disclose here that as scientists and biologists, we normally kill things to study them. That's what we do. We study bacteria through killing them. Not always, but often. So yes, when we go to these environments and we study those microbes, we obviously affect their environment. We open the rock to look inside, and just by doing this, we're affecting their own environment. And then we extract them and we do all kinds of nasty things to understand them. The kinds of things we don't want aliens to do to us, that's what we do to microbes. But that allows us to understand the reasons why, for example, they decided or they moved, colonized the inside of a salty rock, which is, by all intents and purposes, it's a horrible place for a microbe to be. Salt, in fact, is what we use to preserve food. We salt our fish to keep microbes from growing. So in the Atacama, they actually decided to go to a salty place. That gives you an idea of how extreme the alternative outside of the salt is. Microbes would rather live inside a salt rock. And so that's important because, again, that allows us to understand the limits of life on Earth. Now we know the Atacama is not lifeless. We just need to look in the right places. And looking in the right places is what we need to do on other places like Mars. It's not enough to send a lander on Mars and just randomly fall on the surface and start looking for life. The lesson we learn in the Atacama is that you need to choose carefully where you want to go. Because you might go to the wrong place and not find anything, or you might go to the right place and hit the jackpot and find life. So that's, for example, one of the lessons we've learned in the Atacama in the past few years.
When you talk about underwater exploration, it also brings me the idea of Europa and some possible underwater ocean to be explored.
Yeah, follow the water. That's been the mantra of NASA and other space agencies for the past 10, 15 years. Follow the water because water is what's required for life. We don't understand life without water. And where there is water on Earth, there is life. So by following the water, we are narrowing down the places in the solar system where there is the potential for life. Venus, too hot, no liquid water, no life. Mars, now very cold, but not so cold in the past. Evidence of liquid water, maybe life. Europa, there is actually evidence that there is an ocean under the ice shell of Europa. A very large ocean, probably very deep, probably kilometers deep and kilometers thick. A lot of water in there. We know or we think that the ocean is salty, just like the oceans on Earth. And there's fish in the ocean, Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there is fish in Europa, but there is a good chance that there is bacteria or forms of life, simple forms of life, that could have evolved, originated in Europa. It certainly would be a groundbreaking discovery if it was the case. So I can see in the next 10, 15 years, missions going to Europa, solving all the technological issues, which are no doubt very complicated, going to Europa and looking for evidence of life on Europa, as well as other places in the solar system. Europa is not the only destination.
When you talk about that, we are trying to find other lines of life different from Earth, and then possibly we can find something like that on Mars. But when we talk a little bit about the panspermia, that is that probably the blocks of life came from an asteroid, or at least there is the concept. Probably we also share that with Mars because it's kind of close. So that's maybe right. We have the same path, maybe not as a life form, but as with the same blocks of life.
That's right. So Earth and Mars, they've been changing speed, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They've been changing speed in the form of rocks. Mm-hmm. When there has been large impacts on Mars, and when there has been large impacts on Earth, rocks have been ejected into space, mm-hmm. and eventually some of those rocks found their way to Mars or from Mars to the Earth. There are about 100 meteorites that have been recognized on Earth, pieces of rock that came from Mars. Mm-hmm. And looking at the composition of those rocks, we see that, in fact, some of them contain the building blocks of life. Mm-hmm. Not life itself, but the small building blocks that makes our cells. So that tells us that, one, the chemistry of life, it's probably very widespread in the universe. It moves around in rocks. It goes from one planet to the other. Now, a different question is whether life itself moves around in the universe, and that's panspermia, a living cell or a dormant cell that can go from one planet to the other, wake up in the new planet, and start colonizing. Some people think that that's how life originated on Earth. Some people think that life on Earth didn't start on Earth. It actually started on Mars, and it arrived to Earth already as a living cell. And it found the conditions necessary for expanding on our planet. That's a theory that we can actually test. We can go to Mars and search for life, and we can think of two possible scenarios. Well, actually, three scenarios. The first scenario is that there is no life. Mm-hmm. We don't like that scenario. We're out of job if that's the case.
You keep going to another place.
Or we keep going. There's no shortage of places to go, that's for sure. Or there is a chance that there is life on Mars, and then there is two possibilities. It's life that it's related to us because we changed speed, because materials moved from one place to the other, or there is life on Mars and it's not related to us. Mm-hmm. We call that a second genesis, independent mm-hmm. genesis of life. Obviously, the second genesis would be the most exciting thing to discover, because mm-hmm. what it means is that two planets in the same solar system created life independently. That means that life is probably a very common phenomenon in the universe. Something like a living organisms can originate in two planets within the same solar system independently, mm-hmm. then there has to be life everywhere. Mm-hmm. So that would be a very exciting result. Also because it would allow us to understand biochemistry and the chemistry mm-hmm. of life in a much different way than just by looking at ourselves. Mm-hmm. We could see whether they have DNA or a different type of genetic code, whether they use the same proteins, the same building blocks. It would be a great experience to learn. Lots mm-hmm. of students could write PhD theses on a second genesis of life. The alternative is that we go to Mars and we find life and it's actually related to us. It has mm-hmm. DNA in it. It's made of the same things. We can actually, through its chemistry, we can actually tell that they're our distant cousins. Mm-hmm. And that would be proof that of panspermia, that mm-hmm. life can move from one place to the other. Still very interesting, maybe a little less so than a second genesis, mm-hmm. because that really wouldn't tell us much about how widespread life is in the universe.
By Brad Pitt in 2007, Make It Right started as a catalyst for rebuilding New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward, a neighborhood devastated by Hurricane Katrina. Today, Make It Right builds healthy homes, other kinds of buildings, and communities for people in need nationwide. From Newark, New Jersey, to Montana's Fort Peck Indian Reservation, all Make It Right projects comply with the highest standards of green buildings. If you'd like to donate, visit makeitright.org.
And today we're talking with Dr. Alfonso Dávila about research, about space, about Earth, and astrobiology.
When you see the size of our little galaxy in comparison to the big scheme of things, it will make sense that the planet next to us will have the same DNA, or I mean, if it has life at all, will be related to us.
It makes sense that it's related to us. It all comes down to how likely it is for life to originate in the first place. If the origin of life is a phenomenon that it's likely, mm-hmm. that it just happens as long as a few conditions are met, then there is probably life here, life on Mars, and both of them are independent, and there is life in many other planets. Wow. If it turns out that life is actually a very unique phenomenon, that it only under very specific conditions life can happen, then the only way that we can have multiple life within the solar system is likely through exchanging speed. That's one of the reasons why we want to go searching for life, because that's going to allow us to address these fundamental questions.
As Neil deGrasse will put it, we're all made out of stardust.
Star stuff, yeah. That's going to happen no matter what. We're all made of star stuff.
Yeah.
That's another fascinating aspect of life in the universe. Whether we all come from the same place or we come from different places, we're still made of the same stuff.
It is a little bit scary, or like a cautionary tale, looking at Mars and thinking, obviously, that it was like Earth millions of years ago. And then it also comes to us like, well, this is very important to research and to learn, so we don't do it.
Yeah, the astrobiology addresses three questions. Earlier we said that it was a coin with two sides, but it's actually a coin with three sides, if you can have such a thing. One side is the question of the origin of life. How does life originate? The other question in astrobiology is whether there is life elsewhere in the universe, not just on Earth. And the third question is, what's the future of life in the universe? And that question very much has to do with what you just said. How is life going to be affected by a changing universe? And the universe changes. There is nothing static in the universe. Everything moves. The question is how it moves and how fast it moves and where it goes. And we as humans, we are at a point that we can actually affect how things move, how fast they move, and where they go. Mm. And we're learning that probably the hard way now. And by looking at other planets, we can probably better understand the consequences of our actions on our own planet. Certainly Mars, there weren't humans on Mars. Humans were not responsible of what happened on Mars. That one is not on us.
Yeah.
but we can learn that changes on a planet can have a huge impact, not only on the planet itself, but also on the inhabitants of that planet. In fact, there's a very interesting story that happened in our own planet. Mm-hmm. About 2.5 billion years ago, there were some creatures in our planet who decided to do a different type of metabolism. Mm-hmm. They decided that they would rather produce oxygen. They started changing the atmosphere. Back then, there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. And then all of a sudden, these microbes start producing oxygen to the point that they poisoned almost everybody. And there was a huge extinction. And as a result, there was the evolution of complex cells and multicellular organisms and animals and plants, and here we are now. So we are, in fact, the result of a huge catastrophic event, actually a number of catastrophic events.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell where evolution is going to take us. It's hard to predict that what we do, whether it's going to be good or bad. Mm-hmm. But experience tells us that change comes at a cost.
Mm-hmm.
So we will definitely pay for any change we cause.
Yeah.
Whether it turns out to be for the better or for the worst, there's going to be a bill to pay.
Yeah, so maybe life will be preserved, but as a form of a little microbe somewhere, not exactly as us, and we don't like that.
Microbes were there at the origin, and microbes will be there at the end.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we will not be there at the end. I don't think so. We are much more sensitive to change than microbes are.
Mm.
We're much more affected by it. And so I think we need to consider very seriously the fact that we've only been on this planet for a very small fraction of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be a humbling realization.
Yeah.
That things don't really last very long if they don't understand the planet that they live in.
How do you see the changes in these extreme places, like, for example, Atacama, where it's completely dry and is thought to be lifeless in most of its spaces? Is it getting bigger, smaller, hotter, or drier?
It's very hard to tell. In fact, one of the things we've been doing for years is to study the environmental, the weather conditions in these places. So we go to the Atacama, and we deploy stations that collect temperature data, rainfall data, climate data. We go to the Antarctic and we do the same. We leave stations and they, by themselves, they collect data. And now we have a large data set from these different places, maybe 10, 20 years, where we have a very rich history of how the climate has been changing in these places. Turns out it's very hard to predict. It's very hard to tell where the climate is going. Maybe 20 years is not enough to see whether there is climate is going in one direction or another. And on top of that, the climate doesn't change the same way everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Global warming doesn't mean everything is going to warm up. Global warming means that places are going to warm up and other places are going to cool down.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, things are going to change.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to tell whether the Antarctic is cooling up, it's cooling down, or it's warming up.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not whether it's cooling down or it's warming up. The problem is that it's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And the speed of the change is unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
And when things change very fast, we don't really know what's going to happen.
No.
There is a rhythm to things. And if you take things out of rhythm, then there is this coordination. It's like people dancing mm-hmm. on a nice coordinated dance. And all of a sudden, everybody starts doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a matter of time until people start crashing against people and it's a disaster. The climate mm-hmm. is something like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's coordinated. It's a nice dance, balanced dance. If we start randomly changing things very quickly, it's going to spin out of control and we're going to be paying the price.
This is Atenea Americana and I am your host, Isabel Jubes. You may find this and all my shows at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. This is a bilingual cultural show, bringing you a window to the Latin and Hispanic universe. Every week, for 2 hours, one in English and one in Spanish, from Stanford to the world. You can also be part of this, leaving me your comments, sharing your thoughts, and even more at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org.
I invite you to be part of this. And today, we're talking with Dr. Alfonso Dávila about research, about space, about Earth, and astrobiology.
And other than those stations that are actually there collecting data, you also have, NASA has all other satellites around there that are measuring all the changes and the size of all the glaciers, but now they just launched a new one that is measuring the levels of CO2.
CO2 probably and other gases, other atmospheres that are also behave like CO2 in terms of warming up the atmosphere. We call them greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
NASA is known by most people because of their planetary exploration
mm-hmm.
Site, but NASA is actually investing a lot of resources into Earth sciences.
Yeah.
There is a program just as large in NASA, Earth Sciences, which is looking inwards, using mm-hmm. satellites, using airplanes to track the weather, see how the atmosphere changes, see how the ice
mm-hmm.
changes in Greenland, in the Antarctic, in the Arctic, and everything geared towards understanding better the environment. As I was saying, it's very hard to know where the climate is going. We don't have long databases. And also we're looking at very specific locations. We put one station in Chile, and from data from that station, we need to extrapolate to other areas. Whereas through these satellites and these airplanes, we can cover a lot more ground. And so NASA is definitely recognizes the problem of understanding the Earth as a very important issue.
Yeah. All this research into other planets and into life, possibility of life outside, it reflects directly in understanding our life.
Earth is a planet.
Yeah.
Just
how are we
like
going to survive this?
And understanding the Earth is just part of the whole scheme of things.
Yeah.
And understanding other planets allows us to understand Earth better.
Mm-hmm.
And especially allows us to understand the fragility, how things can change dramatically. It's just a question of time.
Yeah, and there was also years ago, I don't know if they keep doing that, this research about how to change completely the environment of Earth in our favor if we, I don't know, launch something into the whole atmosphere that will reflect a certain rays, or we do these big changes, which are also like very dangerous ideas.
That's right. There's been different experiments done trying to, for example, improve the productivity of the oceans by adding some of the missing elements for life, iron, for example, with the hope that you will have more algae growing, and then there's going to be more fish and so on. There's been experiments trying to create clouds to cool down or to increase rainfall. It's not necessarily bad. In fact, I, for one, think that humans should try to do as much as possible to improve conditions. The problem is that we don't really understand the system good enough so that we can manipulate it without consequences.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to understand. In order to understand something, you really need to know how to manipulate it, to build it up. When you start manipulating something, it's because you understand it. But if you go with a blindfold around your eyes and start moving things around without knowing what you're doing, then very, very likely you're going to break something.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is that this is what's happening in these cases, that these experiments make sense in a closed kind of system where you don't take into account anything else, but when you put everything in the larger scheme of things, your experiment here might be doing what you want, but it might be doing something that somebody else doesn't want, and we just don't know enough so that we can manipulate the environment in such a way that it's safe.
Like it has already happened in some places, like you bring some species from outside this environment because one of these animals was growing too much, so let's bring this other animal to eat the other animal. But then this animal grows too much and it's too much, and then the whole thing goes berserk.
Somehow rabbits come to mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it's happened over and over again.
There are fishes in Florida.
Life, like the climate, life is a complex system that we don't really understand. Ecosystems, how the balance between species works. People have been looking at it, and certainly we understand it much better now than in the past. But still, these things happen. Species are introduced, and things go horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. I think it's a lesson that it's a mistake that we keep making. And it's a lesson that somehow we still didn't learn.
So all this research and things that we have been learning through the years, adding one research over the other, they need to keep going for us if we really want to understand, as you say, life and how the Earth works. And now we know that the Earth is something different as we knew a few months ago. How is the reach for the new generations from NASA trying to bring new talent or interest kids into science?
You mean how NASA is doing it?
Yeah.
How NASA is trying? Well, NASA and other agencies and also non-profit organizations like the SETI Institute, they have very active and very strong education and public outreach programs. And so it's recognized that science is not something people do in a room disconnected from the world. Science is something that happens. It's a social thing.
Mm-hmm.
And society needs to take part of it. And probably the most important people in society who need to take part of it are the kids. Because kids, one, they're going to be paying taxes in the future, and they should probably recognize that their taxes are well spent doing science.
Mm-hmm.
It's a selfish reason why we should educate kids in science. because they understand the value of it. The other one is because science, and especially planetary science, is very inspirational. Kids love planets. They love space. They love high temperatures and cold planets and extremes and all these kind of things. And it's easy to grasp their attention by talking about Mars. You talk to them about the Earth, and sooner or later they start getting bored. But you tell them, you talk to them about Mars, and they're going to listen for hours and hours. They can't get enough. Planetary science is a great tool to interest kids into learning new things and be passionate about learning science. So it creates it's a good tool to create a more enlightened society, so to speak. And so for all these reasons, I think it's good that NASA and other agencies and non-profit organizations invest in education and public outreach.
Yeah, as you say, when Earth science and space science, it's like when you try to study a little rock and then you are going to do that for many hours, not many kids are going to keep their attention to it, but put it floating in the middle of the space
they
and
love it.
Everybody will be looking at that.
They love it. And sometimes this is also our fault as scientists and educators. We either because we can't or we don't have enough time or we're too tired or too busy, we don't make science attractive. And that happens. It happens often. It's up to us to make the kids understand the connections between things. Make the kids understand that this rock that they're looking here in California, actually components of this rock came out of a star some time ago. And that there is rocks on the moon that are made of the same thing, and even on Mars. And that the rocks that we study in California allows us to understand the rocks on Mars and whether there is life there. So making these connections, I think, is what captivates the imagination of kids. And it's not easy. It takes time. It takes dedication. But luckily, my experience at NASA and at the SETI Institute, there is people around it that are able to do it in a very good way. And so the result is, the experience is to see the kids, like, big eyes, big smiles, loaded with posters and stickers about NASA and exploration, having a great day visiting.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now you are part of our team.
Yes.
Hopefully we'll have you back.
Definitely.
Because I love these topics.
Definitely.
So
anytime.
Fun.
If I'm not in some distant place in the Atacama or in the Antarctic, I'll be happy to be here.
Hopefully we'll see you soon. And Stanford has a lot of outreach also programs to kids. And putting them both together will be great.
And this was Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Stanford, 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe. This is
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture on the air and online.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Vuelve pronto.
Atenea Americana.
From Stanford to the world.
Remember to come back soon.
Ciao.
See you later.